From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf.
Well, no one told me about her, the way she lied. Well, no one told me about say you're sorry. How would I know? Why should I care? Please don't bother trying to find her. She's not there. Well, let me tell you about the way she looked, the way she had tanned, the color of her hair. Her voice was soft and cool, her eyes were clear and bright, but she's not there.
Of all the bands to come in the wake of the Beatles in the British invasion of America's pop charts, my favorite was The Zombies. They were the least Beatlesque of all of them. Their sound was more keyboard-driven than guitar, and their vocalist had a gentle, sensitive delivery that could not have been more different than The Stones' Mick Jagger or Ray Davies of the Kinks. My guest, Colin Blunstone, lead singer of The Zombies, was the voice you heard singing She's Not There, Tell Her No, and Time of the Season. And if you delved a little deeper, Leave Me Be, Whenever You're Ready, and the LP Odyssey and Oracle. He has also recorded many fine solo recordings, including his newest, On the Air Tonight. Colin Blunstone, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks very much, Gary. Great to be with you.
So, The Zombies formed 50 years ago, right?
They did. They actually formed in 1961. Of course, I mean, as an amateur band, we were basically a school band based in a town called St. Albans, which is just north of London.
And was there a leader of the group, or you just all had your own input, or what?
I think that really from the very beginning, Rod Argent, the keyboard player, was the leader of the band. It was certainly his idea to start up a band in the first place. And it's quite funny, really, because originally he was going to be the lead singer. Well, he was the lead singer, and I was the rhythm guitarist. And then in our very first rehearsal, he just went over to a broken-down old piano in the corner of the rehearsal room. And I remember he played Nut Rocker by Bee Bumble and the Stingers, which was a sort of a classic rock tune of its time. And it's quite a difficult piece to play. And I was just stunned because I was a very average guitarist, and he was a brilliant keyboard player even then. And we persuaded him to become the keyboard player in the band. And then from there on in, as you said, it was very much a keyboard-based band because he's just a world-class player.
And had you guys been schoolmates or what?
The band was divided pretty much down the middle as going to two different schools in the same town. I went to school with the original bass player. In fact, he's the only guy who ever left. He wanted to be a doctor, and his studies got pretty intense, and so he had to leave the band. He was called Paul Arnold, and we sat in alphabetical order in our school. We had to sit in certain places in alphabetical order, and he sat, being Arnold, he sat in front of me, and his neighbor, I didn't know Rod at all, but his neighbor was Rod Argent, who wanted to get a band together. And Paul turned around one day to me and said, "You've got a guitar, do you want to be in a band?" And that was my introduction to the music business.
Well, had you had ambitions of being a singer before that?
None whatsoever, really. Even when the band, I mean, the band was we were an amateur band for 3 or 4 years, and it wasn't till right at the end that any of us sort of dared to hope that we could become professional musicians. I think we all thought it was great fun, and we loved music, and we loved playing music, but to be a professional musician, I just thought it was out of our grasp, you know, beyond our dreams, really. And we won a big local rock competition, and then we were offered a recording contract, and I think then we all thought, well, you know, there's just a chance we could do something, we could be a professional band, and we took that the sort of huge leap that you do, and said, okay, that's it, we'd buy an old truck, and we're going to go off and look for gigs.
Well, before you got involved with the band, what kind of music was to your taste? What were you listening to?
Well, I think that the early Elvis tunes probably I always liked music, in any kind of music, but the early Elvis tunes really sort of changed my outlook on music, and I discovered rock and roll, and so I would have gone from Elvis to Little Richard and Chuck Berry, and they would have been the greats that got me interested in rock and roll. And then I think really the next big influence happened just before we turned professional, and that's the Beatles. I mean, I think they had a huge effect on everybody. But once we were professional musicians, I don't personally think I was particularly influenced by anybody. I was just watching how we naturally evolved, really.
Well, there are some sort of zombie traits that I wonder about. Were you specifically trying not to sound like any of your contemporaries?
No, not at all. It was just completely natural what we were doing. I mean, we were listening very intensely to the Beatles, absolutely, everything they did. But we just, maybe because it's the makeup of the band, it just wasn't a natural thing to try and in any way incorporate what they were doing and what we were doing. We'd always been interested in, well, I always think we were interested in a wide spectrum of music, everyone, from classical music through modern jazz, the blues, rhythm and blues, rock and roll, and pop music. And I think that was one of our strengths. But also, I think in some ways it was one of our weaknesses, because we might have spread ourselves a bit thin, especially for people in the media who like to say that you play a specific kind of music. And if they can't slot you into a specific kind of music, you can lose out on a lot of press and radio because you don't quite fit. And I think that possibly the Zombies suffered from that a little bit, that we did take our influences from such a wide spectrum. But so there's quite a bit of jazz in there. I think most people can hear that. And there's a bit of classical music in there as well. The other thing that we did right from the very beginning was that we incorporated harmonies in the songs that we were doing, which certainly amongst the local bands, you know, that played in North London, I don't think any bands were playing harmonies, were singing harmonies like we were. So that those two things made us quite different. One, that we were a keyboard-based band at a time when all bands were three guitars. And the other thing was that we were using a lot of harmonies right from the very beginning.
Did the Zombies favor minor chords?
Well, looking back, you would think so. You know, a lot of the songs do seem to be written in minor keys. I think in She's Not There it's quite interesting, because it starts in a minor key and then goes to a major key, and that's quite striking.
Yeah.
But there were quite a few songs written in minor keys. But I think, you know, one of the interesting things that I saw in our 3 years on the road with the original Zombies was how Rod and especially Chris White's writing progressed until we came to record Odyssey and Oracle after we'd been on the road for 3 years. And I thought they came up with 12 absolutely classic songs. And, you know, looking back now, I think that that is one of the strengths of the band, possibly the main strength of the band, is that we had two prolific, quite sophisticated writers in the band. And of course, we had first call on their songs.
Oh, that's that album. Of course, it's such an amazing classic album. And you know, here in America, we didn't know anything about that record when you guys actually recorded it. But we're talking with Colin Blunstone, who was the lead singer. I guess still is the lead singer of the Zombies. The Zombies are going to be playing some live dates here in North America in 2013. So, before you got to Odyssey and Oracle, when you were still making your singles, you were saying that maybe the fact that you spread yourselves in a wide, eclectic range might have affected your commercial success. I was also wondering if you think, you know, I was listening recently just earlier today to Whenever You're Ready, which is one of my favorite records of yours, and I'm thinking about how that song says things like, you know, you were hurt and you cried, and whenever she's ready, you'll be there, as opposed to, you know, Under My Thumb and Day Tripper, some of the songs that were...
I would say that song was written by Rod Argent, and generally speaking, I mean, I haven't been through it song by song with Rod, but when I've talked about songwriting with him, he's always emphasized how important to him the sound of the words are, as opposed to the meaning of the words. And so I don't think we should, you know, look too deeply at the meaning of a lot of the songs that Rod wrote, because he's very much looking for the sound, you know, how it sounds when you sing it, if it sounds right. So I know what you mean. There's some of the lyrics, I think more especially Chris's, actually, were a little bit self-effacing and not very dominant, you know.
Did the other members of the group, or did Rod Argent or whoever wrote the song ever tell you how they wanted you to sing it, or did they write it for your voice and just let you do it?
Yeah, well, I mean, Rod has often said that he learnt how to write songs writing songs for my voice, and I would counter by saying that really I learnt to sing professionally as I learnt to sing his songs. So we both grew musically together, I think, in that respect. And yeah, I mean, Rod and I then, and still do, we discuss phrasing in great detail before we record. I'm sometimes a bit envious when I see or hear of people that just walk into the studio and just sing it, or just, you know, perform it very quickly, because we've never really been like that. We've always tried to go into great depth of certainly with regard to the lead vocal, usually with regard to arrangement with the original band and with the band we have now. Rob will be quite definite about what he wants people to play. Not always, but most of the time. And with the original band, I would say that the arrangements came note for note from Rod, really. And for instance, when you listen to the bass line on She's Not There, that was written in the song. That wasn't Chris...
just playing bass.
Finding a bass line, uh-huh, as a bass player, that was written in the song. And, you know, the rhythm track to Time of the Season with the clap and the breath, that's really part of the song.
Yeah. Did you guys record, I know you probably didn't with Odyssey and Oracle, but in your singles, did you record those live in the studio, or did you overdub?
Well, more or less. Certainly earlier on, they were, the band played live. And then I think we went in and did the vocals separately. But on the first sessions, Rod and Chris would be at one mic doing backing vocals, and I would be on another mic singing at the same time doing the lead vocal, and they would go on one track. So it's a complete performance. But they didn't sing the backing tracks while they were playing their instruments. And, I mean, it wasn't so far different the whole time we were together. By the time we got into Abbey Road to do Odyssey and Oracle, we were recording on basically 8 tracks, and it did give us a few options to overdub so that we could double track some backing vocals. And I think that, say, on Time of the Season, there are 2 keyboards.
Yeah.
But it was a lot simpler in those days recording. Well, I don't know if it's simpler or more difficult, really. The process was simpler, but you did have to be able to play, because for the most part, all the takes are complete takes. So when I sang a vocal, it's a complete vocal.
An Odyssey and Oracle. Well, Jeff Emmerich was a guest here on the show, and I asked him.
Right.
I asked him how he happened to get involved in Odyssey and Oracle, and he said, "Oh, they asked me."
Yeah, I've read his book actually, and he does talk briefly about that album, and he was an absolute master as an engineer, Jeff, and we were very lucky, and we also used another engineer called Peter Vince, who was studio engineers at Abbey Road at a time when Abbey Road was the best studio in the world. I don't think there was much debate about that, and we were very, very fortunate to work with both Jeff and Pete.
Were you conscious as you guys were recording Odyssey and Oracle that you were in the studio that the Beatles had used and so on?
We were. For the most part, we recorded in Studio 3 and the Beatles recorded in Studio 2. But they did actually venture up to Studio 3 occasionally. So we were aware of the history of what was happening. And in fact, we pretty much followed them into the studio. We were pretty much the next band in. And there were various percussion instruments lying around, which, and also a lot of keyboards. For instance, the Mellotron was actually in the studio, and that's probably one of the reasons why there's such a lot of Mellotron on Odyssey and Oracle. And we certainly would like to think that those instruments were left there from the Beatles sessions, and that's what we're going to tell people anyway. If it's not quite true, I don't mind. You know, that's part of our story.
It's the time of the season when love runs high. In this time, give it to me easy and let me try with pleasured hands to take you in the sun to promised lands to show you. What's your name?
Who's your daddy?
Who's your daddy? Is he rich like me? Has he taken us
any time
to show? To show you what you need to live.
Tell it to me slowly.
Tell you.
We're talking with Colin Blunstone. In 1969, that's when we first, over here in America, got our first hearing of Odyssey and Oracle and Time of the Season, which became a big hit single over here. And by that time, you guys were broken up.
That's right. When we finished Odyssey and Oracle, I think it got, you know, a couple of good reviews, but as a commercial entity, it wasn't successful. And the industry then was still very, it was just changing, but it was still very singles-orientated. And I believe we had a couple of singles released in the UK, and they didn't chart. And it was decided that the band had sort of run its course, and it was probably better that we all... It was quite amicable, you know. I mean, there weren't any huge rows or anything, but it was probably best that we went off and found new projects to work on. It just, you know, it seemed as though everyone was telling us, your time has come. And... three of the band actually left the business altogether. Rod and Chris stayed in the business because they'd been really quite successful as songwriters, and they were in a position financially where they could start new projects. But the other three of us, who were to a large extent living off the proceeds of us being on the road, we were in a slightly more delicate financial situation, and we all had to get jobs. And I was working 9 to 5 when Time of the Season was a big hit in America. It was a kind of a strange feeling.
What were you doing?
I was a clerk. I mean, I just took the first job that I was offered. I just went to an employment agency and said, "Have you got any jobs?" And it was a huge insurance company, one of the biggest insurance companies in London.
They didn't say, "What can you do?" And you said, "Well, I can sing in minor key."
I know. I didn't actually explore that side of my CV with them, but I didn't know.
Did they know? Did your co-workers know who you were? This is the
yeah,
guy
they said. Did.
Yeah,
yeah.
Because, no big deal.
You know, we'd had quite a few hits over here,
yeah.
But you know that only lasts for a day or two, really. People, you know, might be asking you questions and staring at you, but it was a very, very busy office, and there wasn't time for. For sort of side issues, the phone was ringing. Oh, the phones. I mean, it employed hundreds of people. The phones were ringing all the time, and so you just had to get on with it, really. And in a way, in retrospect, I think it was good for me because I think it was very sad when the band finished. It was the end of an era in our lives, and it had been such an exciting adventure. And it kept me very, very busy. I didn't have time to rethink over things too much. I just had to get on with what I was doing. It's difficult to explain to people, but if you can just imagine a phone ringing every, like, 3 seconds after you put it down, the phone rings again. You just don't have time to think about anything. And I was living somewhere away from that office as well, so there was a long journey in and there was a long journey back. And so I got really, really tired, and I just didn't have time to dwell on the past until suddenly Time of the Season was a huge hit in America, and then people were contacting me about getting back into the music business, and I wasn't sure that I really wanted to do it to start with, but a particular producer called Mike Hurst, who had recorded the early Cat Stevens singles, and they were real classics, and they were big hits in the UK. Right. I don't think they were hits in America, but
Matthew and Son and all that.
Yes, all those. And he contacted me, and we agreed that I would go after work. I would go to Olympic Studios, which is where the Stones were recording. So I'd gone from Abbey Road, where the Beatles were recording, to Olympic Studios. And I'd go in the evening and just put vocals on some tracks that he would record and just see how it felt. And I recorded, one of the tracks I recorded with him went on to be a smallish, a top 30 single in England. And there I was, it all happens and you find that you're immersed in the music business again, and I was off and running. And so that was my only break, about sort of 9 or 10 months when The Zombies finished. I went into the world of commerce on a very, very low level. And then after that, I started recording again.
Did you guys ever consider, you know, once Time of the Season was so successful and they wanted you to come to America, and did you think about reforming, or nobody ever?
No, I didn't think that the feeling was really there, especially not with Rod and Chris, because by the time it happened, they'd got the basis of Argent together, the next band they were involved in.
Right.
And they really felt they were committed to that project. And so it was never really discussed, to be honest.
Well, before we leave this era of the Zombies, I want to ask you about Bunny Lake is Missing. I went to the movies and I saw this movie with Laurence Olivier, and there you were.
I know. I shared a screen with Lord Olivier, or Larry, as I like to call him. It was quite interesting, really. I don't know the details of how it was offered to us, but the offer was something like, we need three songs, new songs, because they wanted a share, the film company wanted a share of the publishing. So they wanted three new songs recorded within about 10 days. And it's a shame, really, that we didn't have a bit more time, and no one had any songs, so they were pretty much written on the spot. And we had to rush into the studio and record them. And then we filmed with Otto Preminger, although we filmed completely on our own, so I never met Laurence Olivier or Carol Lindley or Kia Dallaire, I think, was the other.
Even though they appear to be in the club where you're playing, they weren't actually there.
Well, as I remember, weren't we on a TV screen?
Oh, yeah.
I think we were on a TV screen over a bar in a pub.
Oh,
and Laurence Olivier,
they're in the pub.
As one listens to what we're doing, and he walks across the bar and turns the television off, which I thought, all right, fine.
It wasn't exactly a Hard Day's Night. Did you guys record film more things than were in the film?
No, we just did those three songs. I think it's a bit of a missed opportunity, well, for us anyway, because it was a major release.
Yeah.
And it would have been nice to have taken a bit more time about the writing and recording, but it was out of our hands. That was just, you know, it was take it or leave it. And in fact, it was very interesting because Otto Preminger, by reputation, he's a fairly fearsome man, and he was very dictatorial in that when we filmed it, I mean, I think we spent a couple of days filming, you know, just a few seconds of the film, and he was very aggressive, but he didn't sort of realize it. I mean, he terrorized the people around him. I could see his assistant was in tears because he was being so aggressive. But it didn't really work with us because it didn't mean that much to us. He could take it or leave it. We could take it or leave it.
Yeah.
And on a couple of occasions, we just said to him, look, just forget it. You know, we'll just do it our way. And funnily enough, he just smiled if you said that, you know.
Nobody had ever stood up to him before, apparently.
Well, possibly not. And I can understand that if your whole world is film, then I can understand, and you're contracted to do this film. But we weren't. It wasn't that important to us, and so we just said, look, you know, let's either talk about this sensibly or just forget it. And I don't know if he was shocked or not, but anyway, he quietened down.
So, Colin Blunstone, when you then began recording your solo albums, in, I guess in the early 70s, they had a completely different sound. It was about 20 years, I guess, before you recorded a Zombies record again. And that record, the one I can remember specifically that song, Lula Lula. I thought, oh, that song could have been on Odyssey and Oracle. I love that.
It probably could, couldn't it? I mean, that album came about in a strange way. There was a band in, actually, they were an English band in America. And this has happened many times before. People were impersonating the Zombies. But this band seemed to be getting quite a lot of press. They weren't very good. And Chris White, in particular, felt that it was damaging our legacy, I suppose, you know. And he'd taken legal advice that said, well, if you're not using the name The Zombies, your hold on the name is quite loose. And if someone else wants to use the name of The Zombies and you don't, then it's arguable that they can do it legally. And so he came up with the idea of recording another album. And in some way, you know, looking with the benefit of hindsight, I'm not so sure that we should have really done it in that sort of situation. But we did. Rod stayed on the periphery of it. He wasn't really involved. He did play on a couple of tracks, but he literally just walked in to the studio and just played a few keyboard parts and then left. But interesting
I'm glad
project.
You recorded it. I love that record.
You like it? Oh, good, yeah, good. I think it's got some really good tracks on it. I like Lula Lula.
Yeah.
And I can't remember the name of the tracks off the top of my head. But I think there are some good tracks on it. It was an interesting project. And for me, it led into the next album I did, which I recorded with Chris producing, was an album of all the songs I'd sung on up to that point that had been hits. So it was called Colin Blunstone Sings His Greatest Hits, because it wasn't the original tracks, but we got them very, very close. And so it started a run of recording, because I'm quite fond of that album, which in turn led into something else. And so in its way, it probably did start a sequence of events that were quite favorable for me, really.
That are still going on. But in that 20-year period between Odyssey and Oracle and New World, I think it's called, you had to adjust to new songwriters, new musicians that you were playing with. Was it a completely different experience? What was that like?
Well, it is different. When you're if you're a solo artist, I mean, in many obvious ways, all the decisions and all the responsibilities and whatever pressures there are all on your shoulders, instead of sharing over with five or four other people. So it is a bit different, and I really enjoy it. At the moment, you know, I play in this incarnation of the Zombies that we have at the moment, but I also have a solo band as well, and I enjoy in different ways both of those projects. They are quite different. And with my solo band, I only play two Zombie tunes. I play She's Not There in Time of the Season. I don't play anything else. And quite possibly, sometime in the future, I probably won't play any Zombie tunes at all. I try to keep them very different. But I enjoy both projects equally.
Do you think the Zombies now are going to go on forever? I mean, you've toured with them. You've done a couple live albums. You did a DVD last year. Are the Zombies back?
Oh, I think the plan is to, I mean, you get to a point in life, don't you, where you have to say you're going to play as long as you're physically capable of playing. Obviously, we're not in the first flush of youth, and we're, I'm sure a time will come when someone will say, oh, I don't know, I think this touring is a bit much for me, because this year we're coming to the States three times, and in the last few months we've been to Sweden, Norway, Denmark, Finland, the UK, Holland, the States, Canada, Japan, the Philippines. I may have missed a few out, but we tour, you know, pretty solidly. But we do it because we love to do it. And in fact, I think Rod and I got back together again around 1999 or 2000, and we've toured constantly since then. And we started off, we weren't using the Zombies name at all. It was just an idea that we would play in a band together. I don't think we played many Zombie tunes. And then we got this huge surprise, and I'm being really honest here, we discovered that there was great interest in the Zombies repertoire that we didn't realize was there. And people asked us to play more and more Zombie tunes. I mean, it was very obvious. And also, promoters were billing us as the Zombies without us saying that that was the case. In fact, it got a bit difficult at times because we felt that we were misleading people, or the promoters were, by billing us as the Zombies. And it took 10 or 12 years before we ever used the name the Zombies, and we had to talk to the other original members. And there was a little bit of resistance to start with, but I think now they're happy for us to do it, and if they're happy, then we're happy. So we try to make it as plain as possible. It will be something like The Zombies featuring Colin Blunson and Rod Argent, so that people know it's not the original lineup, with no intention of misleading people. But Chris White and Hugh Grundy haven't really played in a professional setting since the band finished in 1967. And so I think it would be unfair to expect them to get back out on the road again after all this time.
Well, your voice sounds as great as it's ever sounded when you... When you tackle... I love your new album, On the Air Tonight. And your when you tackle your older material, it doesn't sound like 40 years have gone by since you recorded the songs. What do you do to keep your voice going?
Well, I didn't do anything for years and years. Certainly in the original Zombies, no warm-ups, no exercises, no nothing. That was just how my voice was born. But as you get older, I think you do have to start looking after your voice a little bit. And I went to a singing coach about 10 or 12 years ago, and he was a very interesting guy who used to coach a lot of the people in musicals in the West End, which would be the equivalent of Broadway in New York. And these people have to sing night after night. They have to be very accurate in their singing, and their voices have to be pretty tough. And I only took 4 or 5 lessons with him, but he taught me a little bit about technique, and he also gave me a warm-up tape that I'll sing probably twice on a show day. I sing it before sound check. That's sort of half an hour's warming up and half an hour before the show. And I find that really helps. It's made my voice stronger and more accurate. And as you get older, you do need that, because singing is quite a physical thing. It's a bit like, in a way, being an athlete. And as you get older, you can't do some of the things, and especially not as naturally as you could when you were younger. So it really helps to be able to do, have a proper exercise regime. And I think that's been a huge help to me as I've got older.
You never seem to take the low road when you're singing. You just
I know. A lot of the songs we sing are in extremely high keys. And I think it all really started with She's Not There, which is starts in A minor. Mm-hmm. And I'm singing, let me tell you about the way you look. That's a continuous A, which is quite high for a male voice. And I think people thought, well, it seems to work, Colin singing in that part of his voice. And so ever since, people have tended to write, and I've even tended to record in pretty high keys.
No one told me about her. What could I do? No one told me about her. The baby. But it's too late to say I'm sorry. How would I know why she's here? Please don't bother trying to find her. She's not there. Well, let me tell you about the way she looks.
Colin Blunstone, it's really been a treat to talk to you. Thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thanks very much, Gary. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Well, that's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you had a good time. Come back and see us again next week. And check out our podcast page at FromTheBookshelf.com. And you can find us on Facebook and subscribe to the podcast at iTunes. I want to thank my guest, Colin Blunstone, lead singer of The Zombies, his latest solo album, On the Air Tonight. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. Good night.